Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. Our first case today is United States v. Guihama. Ms. Cherkaski, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Colonel Italis, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court, my name is Katie Cherkaski, and along with my co-counsel, Major Heather Bruja, we represent the appellant, Master Sergeant Janelle Guihama. And with the court's permission, I would respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
After 9 hours of custodial interrogation with a seasoned FBI agent repeatedly insisting to Master Sergeant Guihama that he had sexually abused a child at some point in his life, and amidst many dozens of denials by Master Sergeant Guihama, he ultimately relented and provided a statement claiming that he had molested his years earlier. He provided vague and sometimes conflicting details of the circumstances, locations, and years in which the touchings supposedly occurred. When the investigators located Master Sergeant Guihama, they both insisted they had no memory of such a crime ever occurring. They testified consistent with their denials at his trial. There was never a determination about where the alleged crimes took place, to include what state, what house, or what year they supposedly occurred. There were no witnesses produced who claimed Master Sergeant Guihama acted inappropriately with his expressed sexual interest in them, or that they were apprehensive of him in any way. There was no indication that the crimes had occurred at all. But for his confession, elicited after 9 hours of interrogation and amidst repeated and insistent denials. His confession was nevertheless admitted into evidence and used as the sole evidence against him for the sexual abuse of his. And this untenable result came from the military judge's abuse of discretion in admitting a confession that was not corroborated and therefore not trustworthy. The judge's finding was clearly erroneous.
May I ask you a question based on your brief? You indicate that under 304, it's not sufficient for there to be corroboration of collateral facts, that really need corroboration of the criminal acts. So I'd like to better understand your position. Are you saying that there is a bright line that cannot be pierced between collateral facts and the criminal act, or are you instead arguing that sometimes collateral facts are, for lack of a better term, so incidental that they cannot serve as corroboration?
Well, Your Honor, we're not arguing for a bright line rule in terms of the corroborating evidence that can be used, or the independent evidence that is used as corroboration. Rather, we do think under White Eyes, it is a totality of the circumstances that need to be reviewed. And when you're looking individually at each piece of independent evidence, it is important to be able to tie that to the ultimate criminal act instead of simply corroborating factual details contained in the alleged confession. Because essentially what happens if all that the government is required to do is provide committed. But that's not what 304 requires. It actually requires an inference of the truthfulness of the confession itself, not simply corroboration of independent facts like he had and he was in a specific state at some point in time. So in order for a confession to not be corroborated under the government's view of the case, from my reading, the defense would be required to essentially disprove all of those facts. But in doing so, that does not make the confession actually trustworthy.
So let me ask the other side of that same coin. You're talking about what the defense would need to prove if, in your view, this wasn't handled appropriately in terms of the collateral facts. In this specific case, what would have needed to have been corroborated by the government to indicate that, in fact, this confession should have been admitted into evidence?
Well, I think we can look to much of the precedent that discusses 304 cases. And in fact, United States versus Arno discusses the requirement of specificities. In that case, the court said that when determining whether evidence tends to establish the trustworthiness of a confession, a relevant consideration is the specificity of the corroborating evidence, including specific information such as where and when the abuse took place. In this case, none of that was ever established. In fact, there's never been any sort of specificity regarding the year or the location or the other people who were present during any of these alleged crimes. And in fact, Master Sergeant Gihama's confession alleged that these crimes took place in the state of Missouri, but according to the military judge's finding, these crimes supposedly took place in the state of Texas. So I think you're looking really at the specificity of what the evidence is to tie it closer to what would be required under 304.
Okay. So then I'm saying in this particular case, where you have the victims who were asleep, there are no witnesses, there's no security camera. What theoretically would the government have had to point to as corroboration of this particular confession absent witnesses?
Sure. I think that the government could have pointed to a specific occasion where they was together. They could have pointed to evidence that there was a change in demeanor towards them. They could have presented.
But why would there be a change in demeanor if they weren't aware of the fondling?
Yes, Your Honor, that's a good point. I think there could have been medical evidence, and if there was a molestation of some sort, there could have been
My point is, there wasn't. That's why I'm tying it to the facts of this particular case. We've got a fondling. How would the government ever, when there are no witnesses, there can't be any type of medical evidence, there's no basis to believe that the victims would have acted differently because they were not aware. You've got this confession where he states that he did this. How would the government ever get that confession admitted into evidence?
Again, I think that you would need a totality of the circumstances analysis. And in this case, for example, one of the alleged victims doesn't remember even any point in time where he had these supposed sleepovers with his uncle. I think if you had
so what if we had memories, what if we had an infant who had been victim of this, and an accused confesses to fondling of an infant? Is there some type of carve out where a confession in that instance would not be admissible?
At a certain point, the corroboration analysis needs to yield to whether there was or was not corroboration. And there needs to be specificity. That's our position, that there needs to be specific evidence that actually ties to the criminal act and not simply corroboration of the factual statements that are contained in the confession, things that essentially the defense would have to disprove in order for it to not be corroborated. And certainly, if somebody confesses to committing a crime, it would be an incentive of the government to seek evidence that establishes that. But if they cannot put the accused person in a specific place with the specific victims in a specific time frame, and they just simply don't have any of those connecting dots, then I would suggest that the confession is not corroborated.
In your view, have we taken that approach in prior cases involving corroboration of confessions?
I believe that in White Eyes, there was a good discussion in the concurrence regarding some of the lack of connectivity that the independent evidence had to the ultimate criminal act. And so certainly I would suggest that this court look very closely at each of the pieces of independent evidence that were raised here compared to not only White Eyes, but we have other cases like United States versus Baldwin, United States versus Melvin, in which the corroborating evidence, the independent evidence that was presented, is very specifically tied to the confession. For example, in Melvin, there was independent evidence in the record that showed at the time of the arrest, the appellant was in possession of heroin, the very drug he confessed to using. The heroin was contained in cigarettes, the same method he had confessed to using the substance in. They found other drug paraphernalia. They saw him leaving a drug dealer's house. You can see how that starkly contrasts with the very vague and nonspecific evidence that was used in this case for corroboration.
And but isn't it a continuum? Certainly the case you're citing had very detailed corroboration. But we have other cases out there when it comes to corroborating collateral facts, don't we?
And I'm not suggesting that collateral facts cannot be used as part of the total corroboration analysis, but when we're looking at the overall trustworthiness of the confession and whether what the person confessed to actually occurred, whether if somebody says they murdered somebody, the person doesn't show up 10 years later alive, while somebody's sitting in jail, certainly that's the genesis of all this. I think that we do need to take a look at how overall those facts tend to corroborate. And we haven't even discussed here the genesis of this confession, and it is our position that this court should consider the circumstances under which a confession arises.
Counsel, before we get to that.
No, go ahead.
Before we get to that part of your argument, just one point of clarification on what we were just talking about. Are we really talking here about step two of the White Eyes analysis or step three, which is to say that, okay, we've got some independent evidence, so that's step one. Does it tend to raise an inference of the truth of some element, some aspects of the confession? And it might be about collateral matters, but isn't what you're talking about, it just doesn't do enough to finish step three? Is that what we're talking about? Are you sort of saying that if it's not good in collateral matters, you can't even pass step two? So you're saying that he has it, that passes step two, but then when we get to step three, it's just not enough to establish the trustworthiness. Is that what we're saying?
It depends on the additional evidence that's used for purposes of corroboration. And so, for example, in this case, the corroborating evidence that was relied upon by the military judge and then subsequently by the lower court, which actually added on additional pieces of evidence, in my view, because they likely didn't think that the lower court, the trial court, you had enough to corroborate, was very vague and broad things such as he saw them at some point in the certain years. He had taken leave, not even specifically to a particular destination, just hypothetically that he could have traveled to see them. The other pieces of it we take a bigger issue, that they distinctly remember watching movies with him. But again, the evidence of the record actually does not support that. When the nephew was asked if he had any memory of any time when him watched movies with Sergeant Nihama and fell asleep, he responded, no. And again, that they denied knowledge of the touching, which I would specifically ask this court to suggest is not corroborating evidence whatsoever. A lack of evidence, denial of victimization.
But counsel, why would that not corroborate his statement that the children were asleep and they never woke up during the alleged found?
Well, by that same vein, if they had remembered that he had touched them, would that corroborate it? It's like a zero-sum game that the government can never lose in that case. And I certainly would suggest that a denial of victimization is not akin to, for example, a missing wallet, which is what the United States versus C suggests can be used as corroborating evidence to a confession of larceny. A missing wallet is an element of an offense. A denial of victimization should certainly not be used as evidence against my client for corroboration purposes. And again, I would say that the opposite cannot also be true. Both cannot be corroborative of the same confession. So to that end, and then again, you have the emotional response that was supposedly used as consciousness of guilt, which we dispute is absolutely proper consciousness of guilt evidence. As the United States versus Clark has held, subtle presence of demeanor evidence is not admissible as relevant to the consciousness of guilt because it is equally susceptible to other inferences. So again, going back to your question, I think that we're looking at the third prong of White Eyes in terms of the totality of circumstances. This is an overall trustworthiness analysis. And when you have questions about first the genesis of the confession, because it came about under very extenuating and strenuous interrogation circumstances, on top of the denial of victimization by both alleged victims, on top of no specificity about the location, the years, the other people present, the details, or any of those things, at some point the confession is simply not corroborated.
Counsel, on the third step, and particularly the argument that I interrupted you on and that you weren't able to get to, but about whether you can take into account all the circumstances, including the circumstances of the confession. Wouldn't your position sort of suggest we had to have a whole trial on the merits before we could decide whether to, maybe not a whole trial on the merits, but a much more complete trial before we could even decide whether to admit the confession, such that the voluntariness is sort of a secondary issue, but we'd have to consider that and everything else if we do, if we take that approach that you're looking at? I'm just trying to think of what we would be telling the military judges they have to do before they could decide whether to admit the, decide whether step three of White Eyes was passed.
Sure, and I don't think that it would be much more of an additional burden. The military judge already engaged in essentially fact-finding analysis, and the circumstances of the confession, I believe, are another piece of independent evidence that should be considered. And that's not to say that in some cases where there's very strenuous circumstances where the confession comes from, that it can't also then be corroborated, but it would, in my mind, require additional corroborating evidence, stronger corroborating evidence than certainly what we have in this case. And so I don't believe it imposes much of a significant additional burden on the military judge. And again, the analysis of voluntariness, which is not before this court right now, is separate, but it certainly overlaps with the idea of how this confession came to be. And I believe that the military judge should be required to articulate the consideration of how it came about. That's the first and foremost consideration as to something being trustworthy or not.
Counsel, I'm sorry. Please take it.
That would be new law, though, right, for us? For us to decide that when the voluntariness is conceded or not preserved, then for us to consider the circumstances of the confession in our corroboration analysis, that would be, we've never done that before, right? That would be something new that we would be adding to our analysis, right?
I think you can look at it that way, but I don't actually think it's essentially a further clarification of the White Eyes criteria. The third prong of White Eyes requires that the military judge assess whether the pieces of independent evidence considered together tend to establish the trustworthiness of the admission or confession. And our suggestion is that one of those pieces of independent evidence is the circumstances under which it arose. And certainly in a case such as this, where you have a very significant lead up to this ultimate alleged confession, there may be a requirement to have more specific and more compelling additional evidence on top of that. I don't believe it adds much more of a significant burden in conducting that analysis. It's simply another factor to be considered under the existing framework.
May I ask one more question? So this is not your case, but I mean, suppose that they had testified against your client and had said that they had a recollection of molestation. I know this is not the case, but could the judge consider that in considering the trustworthiness of the confession, such that not the circumstances under which you made it, but if we're going to consider all the circumstances, could the judge consider the other evidence in the case in determining whether it was trustworthy?
If I'm understanding you correctly, I would suggest that would be appropriate for the judge to consider all of the circumstances and anything that tends to corroborate the confession. And if they have complaining victims that are going to testify consistent with the confession, I would tend to believe that the confession would be more easily corroborated under that analysis, certainly.
More questions? I actually have one more question. In terms of your explanation about the circumstances of the interrogation being a factor, hasn't that already been baked into 304? We've got a situation where we have somebody confessing, saying, I did this. And the point of 304 is we want to make sure that the pressures of interrogation didn't result in a false confession. So, military judge, you must jump through these hoops. So hasn't that concern that you're expressing already been baked into 304?
Well, in this particular case, the judge affirmatively declined to consider the circumstances in terms of whether the confession was corroborated under 304. Instead, briefly address the idea that it was voluntary, he had waived his rights, he was an intelligent individual, and that was kind of the end of that analysis. So certainly I don't think that was considered here. I would agree that I think that under 304 and the interpretation in White Eyes, you can certainly consider that and should consider that information, but in this particular case, the judge affirmatively decided not to do that, deeming it not necessary, which we would obviously dispute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kasky. Colonel Italis. So let's get down to that. So you've given us the broad overview of your position generally, but of course we're dealing with the specifics. We've got a military judge who is saying, the fact that the victims can't remember this corroborates the truthfulness of the confession. That is a very curious proposition, that the inability to remember something, the lack of evidence corroborates a confession.
That is just one piece of evidence that the judge has.
Okay, but I'd like you, please, that is partly what the military judge ruled on and used, so I'm asking you to defend that position.
Yes, Your Honor. If you consider a molestation or crime of sexual abuse, it is likely that the victims will remember that they would have some memory of how they were tricked into either taking the clothes off or touching them or something like that. And the fact that they don't remember, and it's consistent with his confession that he suggested, or he said that they're not going to remember because they were asleep, and for that reason, it provides an inference of the truth. It doesn't establish the truthfulness of it, just the inference of the truth, given the manner in which he described it.
I understand the logic there, but like, don't we hope that if you surveyed children across the country, 98-99% of them, hopefully a lot more, would say they have no memory of being molested by their uncle? Like really, I mean, how meaningful? I understand the logic that the military judge was relying on, but I think appellant's counsel has a good point. It's a no-lose situation for the government. If they remember the molestation, hey, it's evidence of the molestation. If they don't, also evidence of the molestation. It seems like it's an impossible situation for the defense.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand, and I understand the appellant's argument. But when you bundle that with other evidence, it's just one piece of it. We didn't expect them to understand, et cetera. We didn't expect them to remember. They didn't remember. It's something that cuts in favor, however slight it is, when you bundle up with the other evidence that we have. And so we look at the other evidence.
But it goes to the point of, certainly the government can say it's a neutral factor that they didn't remember it. But instead, the military judge is saying, aha, it's kind of like the Sherlock Holmes with the dog that didn't bark in the night. But this is a very different situation where no evidence leads to corroboration of a confession.
Well, I think no evidence in some circumstances can lead. It's circumstantial evidence. I mean, if we look outside.
But we're talking about this case. We're not talking about theoretical, hypotheticals.
Yes, Your Honor. And what we can say is that we look at what his statement says. He says they're not going to remember, and they don't remember. And however slight that inference of circumstantial evidence is, it still is consistent with his confession and consistent with the fact that he's telling the truth and being truthful. However slight it is, it still provides an inference of the truth. And taking in isolation in a vacuum, it would not be enough. And it wouldn't add to an inference of the truth if we didn't have this additional evidence.
So let's look at another piece of evidence, the emotional reaction of the appellant. So somebody recoils when they're accused of or asked about whether they have ever sexually touched a child, and that emotional reaction is something that can be used to corroborate the confession?
Well, I think we have to look at the circumstances of this case, and here he's being questioned about child pornography, possession of child pornography, and he's being questioned for quite a while. We're looking at, you know, he's in front of his house in a car, and he's talking about downloading child pornography. And then he's talking about being sexually aroused by images of nude children. And he has no affect, no emotion whatsoever. And so we know that it's not because that he's being questioned by the investigators. We know it's not because of the subject matter. But then when they broach the subject of touching the child, that's when it becomes emotional. And that's what makes it significant. So I think it would be confounded if he became emotional right at the beginning and he was displaying all sorts of emotion, but he had flat emotion up until the moment where they mentioned the fondling or the possibility of fondling. And that's what makes it significant in this case.
Now, this was a finding by the CCA.
That's correct.
And only by the CCA.
That's correct.
What's this court's standard of review of their determination that this is the emotional reaction can be considered?
So, under Perkins, the reviewing court can defend on the entire record or theory that wasn't necessarily raised at the trial level. And the theory is the same. This would just be additional evidence that was actually before the military judge because it was admitted as a prosecution exhibit, and it was the emotional response was identified in that prosecution exhibit that was before the judge when she made the ruling on corroboration. So it's something that the CCA could consider, and it's something that this court could consider.
Okay, but in terms of consider, are you saying we're looking at this de novo? Are we saying plain error? Are we saying abuse of discretion? How are we looking at this in light of the fact that it is the CCA that has offered this? Are we saying, well, we might have gone in a different way here? Emotional reaction doesn't strike us the way that it apparently struck the CCA, but applying an abuse of discretion standard, we come out in a different way on this. So that's why I'm asking.
And I think it would be an abuse of discretion because that's the overall umbrella under which the military judge is judged with, or the reviewing standard for the military judge. So I still think it would be an abuse of discretion.
So even though we're piercing the CCA, looking at what the military judge did, essentially on this point that the CCA pulled into its analysis, we're applying abuse of discretion? I'm asking. I'm not arguing.
And I think it's because this evidence, I think the analysis would be because this evidence was before the military judge. And could the military judge have considered this? When at the time of the motion, she looked at this, and this was something that she could have considered. But she didn't.
She didn't draw any inferences from that.
Well, because there was so much other evidence, the in the living room on an air mattress, bunked out with sleeping and watching movies repeatedly, was such a unique situation that I think that that adds a wealth of corroboration in these circumstances. And if you consider White Eyes with the changing table, was unremarkable for the most part. And I think this court had a hard time with the changing table because every child has to have their diapers changed. But in this case, you have a very unique and specific circumstance. You have him on an air mattress, bunking out with children that are not his, and children that corroborate that they watched the movies numerous times and that they fell asleep, thereby providing him an opportunity to commit the offense.
So then let me ask you this based on what you've just stated. If this court were to disregard the emotional reaction, was to disregard the idea that the fact that the victims don't recall tends to indicate the trustworthiness of the confession. You're saying standing alone, sleeping in a living room on an air mattress, oh, and you have to take out the Texas versus Missouri differences in the testimony here. You're saying that what you've just recapped there, standing alone, was sufficient to corroborate this confession?
Yes, Your Honor. That's our position. And it's not just that he was able to, he described a very distinct set of circumstances where he is, you know, able to watch movies with young children. They're sleeping in the living room, and they're watching these movies. And the fact that that happened, we have independent evidence that that actually happens, makes it more likely that he's actually telling the truth. And this is not a routine activity like we had in White Eyes with the changing table. This is something that only happened with the appellant. And then you might be asking yourself,
Wait a minute. What do you mean by that? This is something that's only happened with appellant. Are you saying nationwide this doesn't happen where people have movie nights and people fall asleep? Or are you saying that there's affirmatively no evidence on the record that anyone else in this household, I don't remember that being in the JA, anybody else ever slept over?
So in the joint appendix, I think it was the younger or the older, but she testified that this is something, this movie night where they all got together and watched a movie, was something that only happened with appellant. And that underscores why this is such a unique event. Because when the kids were at home with their parents, they would, you know, maybe go in their room, watch TV, watch their computer, watch their phone, or they would disperse. And it was only when they were with the appellant that they would come together and have this movie night. So it was kind of contrived. And so the next question is how does
Was it the who initiated these movie nights?
It was the initiated the movie nights. Yes, Your Honor. That's our position as well, and that's what the evidence supports. But the question that comes to your mind, or what might come to your mind, is how does a middle-aged man who's been living in Texas since 2010, and he had an appointment in there, how does he find himself or make it possible that he's able to sleep in the same room and watch movies with these children? And that's where the relationship is really relevant, because he, you know, for lack of a better term, you could say that he's grooming the children and the parents. He's grooming the children so that they trust him to sleep in the same room with him, and he's grooming the parents where he normalizes the behavior, where they're okay with having a middle-aged man who's, shack up with their kids on an air mattress and watch movies repeatedly.
Counsel, can you address appellant's point that all of this evidence really goes to collateral matters and not to the act itself?
So I don't think it's collateral when you have him in the exact location and the circumstances and the opportunity to commit the offense. What would be collateral, in my opinion, is the specific house that it occurred. You know, did it happen in Missouri? Did it happen in Texas? Did it happen at his house in Texas, or did it happen at his in-law's house? That would be collateral. But the situs of the crime and committing it in a matter, having the opportunity to commit it in the manner that you described, those are not collateral.
Do you agree then with the rule corroboration of collateral matters wouldn't be enough to pass step three of the White Eyes test? You're just saying that this isn't collateral.
I think that, in some circumstances, collateral evidence would be enough under the revised 304C. I mean, because what we've eliminated, we can look at Arno and Delgado and this court in White Eyes, and we've eliminated essentially the requirement that it relates to criminality. We're looking for it, the evidence of truthfulness, or evidence that tends to establish the truthfulness of the confession. So I do think in certain circumstances that merely collateral evidence that is present could be enough to corroborate a confession.
And what about the voluntariness of the confession? Why wouldn't the military judge consider all the circumstances in getting to the trustworthiness of the confession?
Well, 304A is something that the judge could look at, the voluntariness of the statement, and corroboration, the issue that's before this court, is separate. I see that it's baked into the analysis, and the military judge looked at the voluntariness, and so did AFCA. They looked at the voluntariness. And I would point out that The voluntariness of the confession, I mean, it was 9 hours, but it was essentially a duty day. It was broken up into four separate interviews, and he never seems to be under any sort of distress. This isn't the old days where we have to wonder what his demeanor was and what was said. We can actually watch and listen to the video, and he doesn't look to be under any sort of distress. And really, the fact that cuts most in favor of the government is that the investigators are, you know, developing a theme and theory. And he's able to push back with that theme and theory. AFCA really pointed this out. You know, you molested these children because your wife had cheated on you. And he's like, no, that's not the case at all. So he's able to push back, and that really suggests that it's a voluntary confession because he's not just accepting their narrative and parroting it back to him. And then they say something to the effect of, it was voluntary. And he's able to push back and say, no, it wasn't voluntary.
But isn't your argument here going to the merits about whether this is trustworthy or not, as opposed to whether any of that stuff can be considered in the step three of the white eyes analysis?
So can you repeat your question?
Well, I mean, what you've just said is it really, really was voluntary. But I think the position that the appellant just wants us to take is whether the extent to which it was voluntary is a factor that should be considered in step three of the analysis. And my question is that correct? Do we consider the circumstances of the confession when doing step three of the analysis? And what you were just saying is, well, go ahead and consider it because it supports us. But I sort of thought your position in the brief was don't consider it.
And that's our position. And because
the latter is your position.
I do think it favors the government under these circumstances. But I don't think it's something that this court should consider because we have the voluntariness construct. We have 304A. So I don't think it's something we're conflating the two issues because it's clearly absent from the plain language of 304C. It's a separate angle that we're looking at when we're looking at trustworthiness as opposed to voluntariness. So to answer your question, no. I don't think this court should consider the voluntariness of it.
What's the government's position about this court's consideration of appellant's possession of child pornography as it comes to the corroboration of the confession?
I think that it's a trove of evidence that could be considered by this court, and it goes to his motive. And you can break it down in a number of ways. What was before the military judge was the child pornography forensic report, and we can tell that he had organized his child pornography in random, unsorted boy and girl. And so that's indicative of someone who has an interest in child pornography of boys and girls. And here he's confessed to not molesting just, a child, but he's molested a boy and a girl. So that raises an inference of truth because it makes it more likely that, he's interested in both, and here he's molested both. And so that's something that you could add. And then one of the most important pieces of evidence is you break up the confession. You have the first session where he's talking about child pornography. And he talks about, and I brought this up before, that he's aroused by underage nude children. So he's confessing to a motive. This part of the confession gives him a motive to later commit the offense of fondling because we know that he's sexually attracted to them. So we can look at the record, we can look at that first piece of evidence, and that would be 404B evidence of a motive that he has. And then so here you have someone who has a motive, someone who's aroused by children, and he's alone in a living room with these children later on. So I think that that portion of the child pornography, his motive, the possession, I think it all supports corroboration in this case. And it was before the military judge, but the military judge pulled back and stopped the analysis because I think she had sufficient corroboration with just the consistency of the location and the method in which it occurred. So, Your Honor, I would... pending your questions, I would conclude if there's...
Any further questions?
Can I ask just one question about step two of white eyes, where step two of white eyes, it just has to support an inference of the truth. Does that mean it just has to be relevant? I mean, so for example, they have no recollection, therefore it's relevant to supporting this idea, supporting the aspect of the confession that they were asleep. I mean, is that all we mean by supporting inference?
I agree. I do. I do think that it just has to be relevant. The standard is so low that if it's relevant to the confession, then it's to answer your question, yes, that it's.
Any further questions?
No.
Please briefly finish.
You know, I mean, this 304 C was amended for cases just like this where we don't have proof of physical damage or trauma or witnesses. And where we have, just to throw additional evidence of truthfulness, I ask that this court.
Thank you, Colonel Attals. Mr. Kasky?
Of a confession that was likely corroborated versus one that was not. And that deals with the child pornography. When Master Mukin Kama was confronted about allegations of possessing child pornography, he did immediately, without being pressured, without being subjected to 9 hours of insistent suggestions by the agent, he did admit to possessing child pornography, and that confession was corroborated by the digital evidence that was in the possession of the agents. That's a stark contrast to the alleged confession that came about hours upon hours later with insistent denials, with high-pressure tactics from the interrogator that, again, was not corroborated by any direct or specific evidence in the same manner as the child pornography confession. And to the point of the child pornography being used to corroborate confession to the touchings. The child pornography offenses are all post-dated for the touchings. So certainly the analysis that was some sort of progression of interest in children would not be relevant here. The dates do not line up simply at all. So
do you have any evidence to support? That this interest could have been new or could have come about somewhere between the alleged offenses of the touching and 2018? Or is that just an argument?
It's a possibility, but when we're talking about specific evidence that is used to corroborate the overall trustworthiness of a confession to a specific crime, again, in a specific place, with specific people there, then it wouldn't be relevant. It just raises a mere theoretical or hypothetical possibility that something could have occurred, but that is not the standard under 304, and we would ask that this court require the military judge to make an overall finding of the trustworthiness of a confession based upon beginning with the genesis of that confession, the circumstances under which it arose, and then using evidence that actually corroborates the criminality, not simply collateral facts that would, in our view, result in a burden shift to the defense to disprove all factual statements contained in an alleged confession, which does nothing to infer the truthfulness or the trustworthiness of it, but it's simply a myopic view of trying to find corroboration through some sort of piecemeal analysis while ignoring the overall significant issues with what we would consider the trustworthiness. When somebody is pressured into saying something that they deny for hours upon hours upon hours, versus when somebody's confronted about the child pornography and essentially immediately concedes to that. That's a pretty stark example of a questionable circumstance. And then following that on with the fact that, and I see that I'm out of time here, may I briefly conclude?
Briefly. Questions first, though? Any further questions?
Well, can I ask one?
Please.
Some of us are already on record about whether evidence of motive is appropriate to corroborate a confession, but to the extent that some of us are undecided about that, do you want to make a pitch as to why it's inappropriate? I know you've already made the time difference argument, but that maybe do you want to make a categorical argument that evidence of motive is not an appropriate way of corroborating a confession?
I would not take that position, Your Honor. I think that, again, it would depend on the specific factors in a particular case. And in this case, the motive, I don't believe, can be established by later in time possession of child pornography that They have no evidence it was in his possession at the time the alleged offense was that he confessed to.
Please briefly conclude.
We would ask that this court require, as part of the White Eyes analysis, would require a military judge to expressly consider the circumstances of the confession in determining its overall trustworthiness. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
Rise. The court stands in recess until 10:25.